Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, it's not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday. Here on the Brian Lehrer Show, we like to pick up on things that came up briefly on the program during the week and dig a little bit deeper if we think they're interesting or meaningful or just fun. And in our first full week of 2009, the news did not disappoint. Our guests did not disappoint. Lots to follow up on. Starting on Monday's show with something that came up during our interview with Congresswoman Yvette Clark of Brooklyn. We were discussing the Obama stimulus package and the idea being kicked around that the bill should be posted online for 1 week for all to see in the interest of transparency to ward off the special interests. Keywords, special interests. Here was her reaction to that idea.
We know that we've got to be creative and really be accountable. Yeah.
Well, who knows what special...
I believe that there has to be transparency and that we should post it online.
Who knows what special interest things are going to be slipped in there at the last minute.
You know, Brian, I don't know how special interests have become such a negative when it comes to doing the type of infrastructure work that needs to be done in this nation. I think that accountability is important, transparency is important, but people have taken the whole moniker of special interest and made it such a negative that I don't know how you get anything done in this nation, which is a capitalist nation, without someone's interest being addressed in that process.
Isn't that interesting? Congresswoman Clark saying, I don't know how special interests has become such a negative in our political discourse from our show on Monday. Now, she's right that it's negative. I used it that way. And take a listen to President Barack Obama, President-elect Obama, yesterday from his big stimulus speech.
No longer can we allow Wall Street wrongdoers to slip through regulatory cracks. No longer can we allow special interests to put their thumbs on the economic scales. No longer can we allow the unscrupulous lending and borrowing that leads only to destructive cycles of bubble and bust. It is time to set a new course for this economy, and that change must begin now.
There they were, special interests right alongside Washington wrongdoers and unscrupulous lenders. Not the best company. So why do special interests get such a bad rap? Aren't all interests special? To help follow up, we welcome Mary Boyle, Vice President of Communications for Common Cause, which bills itself as a nonpartisan citizens lobbying organization. Hi, Mary. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks very much.
So as a lobbying organization, are you like Yvette Clark, like I'm a special interest and proud of it?
Well, you know, she's right in a sense that we are all special interests, and special interest certainly has been used in a negative sense. Everyone has the right to go and lobby their government and ask for something. I think what we're talking about here and what kind of defines a special interest are the groups or the industries that come in with huge amounts of money before them and use that money to give campaign contributions and lobby members of Congress, gaining this kind of access and influence that the rest of us don't have.
And interestingly, though, in the clip, Congresswoman Clark said you can't get anything done in this nation, a capitalist nation, she said, without special interests. So mm-hmm. is there something particularly about capitalism and competitiveness that leads to lobbying and fighting for attention?
Well, I mean, I think a capitalist society, you know, this idea that money can buy you anything. And the reality is that is how it has become. We have a corrupting system right now where our elected officials need money because it is so expensive to run for office. And the people who most want to help them raise and give that money are these so-called special interests who want the most in return. And it's a broken system, and we've got to get rid of it. In fact, today, Common Cause is announcing a comprehensive reform package to address this. And we really feel that the heart of this, the way to stop this, access and influence buying, that the result is, you know, this undermining of public confidence and an agenda, a national agenda that is driven by the special interests, is to go to a new campaign finance system that allows candidates to run with a blend of small private contributions and public money.
So is the difference between a good special interest and a, you know, a bad one just that one has a lot more money to spend?
I certainly don't think there are good and bad special interests. I think that the Congresswoman is right when she said that lobbyists and special interests are an integral and very necessary part of our government. I think what's good and bad all depends on your perspective. What we believe is that you shouldn't have to have, that the public good should not suffer because special interests are ahead with all their money. That, you know, we send our members of Congress to Washington to represent the public interest and the public good.
So what's the future of special interests under an Obama administration, as far as you could tell so far, starting with the stimulus package, which he insists will stay free from special interests? Everyone nevertheless has their eyes on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have yet to see what happens there. But without a doubt, as this stimulus and is you know, kind of handed out and distributed to the states, it just creates this environment that is so ripe for pay to play. And we also think that we need to. Connecticut has a very good pay to play style law that bans campaign contributions and fundraising by lobbyists and government contractors when they have business before the state. And that is something that every state in America should be looking at right now, or every citizen in America should be pushing their state to look at to protect this taxpayer money.
Mary Boyle, Vice President of Communications for Common Cause. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
More follow-up Friday now, and Congresswoman Yvette Clarke was a follow-up generating machine on our show Monday, as it turns out, because she provided our next item, too. This from our discussion of one of her main concerns these days, student loans and college affordability. Take a listen.
You know, what has happened is students are really becoming very, 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 very worried about access to capital. And as a result of that, they're vulnerable to these private loan operations that are almost like loan sharks. And the interest rates, the way that they are regulated, is really, there is no regulation. And so students are forced, because of the cost of education today, to take out these loans. We want to get some accountability. These are companies that are standing in line to be supported through the bailout. And if there's any federal support out there for these companies, we want to make sure that they have the best interests of our students at heart. And we wanted to make sure it was really, really within the bailout.
Meaning that they're not being gouged?
That's right.
Now, this is one of our main interests on the show these days. We've done many segments on college affordability, student debt, predatory credit card practices, and the intersection of all those things before. And so let's dig a little deeper on what Congresswoman Clark said right there. And for that, we welcome back Anya Kamenetz, staff writer for Fast Company, the author of the book Generation Debt and the Generation Debt blog. Hi, Anya. Welcome back to WNYC.
Morning, Brian. How are you?
Good. She was making the distinction between private student loans and federal student loans. And I gather from her material that only 8% of student loans are private. What's really the distinction?
Well, you know, it's a little more complicated than that. Actually, private student loans are taking up about 20% of by volume of all student loans.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is the degree of government backing. So the regular student loan that most people take out would be either a Stafford loan, a direct loan. Those are backed by the government. The interest is subsidized. private student loans are marketed sometimes directly to students. They're also called alternative education loans. They are not backed by the government. The interest rates are higher. The terms are far more punitive for students.
And do you see gouging there and loan sharking, as she called it?
Well, I mean, really the situation is, I mean, the private student loans, the interest rates are ranging in the 9% range, 11% range, sometimes even higher. There are shadier areas of the market, particularly when you look at some proprietary schools, some less accredited colleges that work very closely with these private student lenders, and they market their loans aggressively to students. Overall, but I think in the overall market, you know, the larger problem is, why are students having to rely on debt in the first place?
Go ahead.
Well, even when borrowers are borrowing, you know, so-called federally subsidized student loans, those prices are very high as well, and there's no bankruptcy protection for those either. So there are problems with student loans on both sides of the private-public divide.
Congresswoman Clark also intimated that these companies are lining up for federal bailout money and federal assistance. Are you hearing this, particularly with companies that are offering private student loans?
Well, actually, the largest student lenders in the marketplace who offer, like Sallie Mae, who offer both private student loans as well as federally subsidized loans, are already receiving bailout money.
Mm-hmm.
So quietly, the Department of Education has made a deal to funnel capital to buy up delinquent loans. They're throwing about $500 million a week as we speak into these student lenders who are banks, who are basically serving as middlemen, both for the federally subsidized programs as well as private education loans. So, yes, the bailout is happening. Now, the interesting part about that is the bailout actually is working pretty well. So unlike what we've seen with the banks in mortgage lending, there were many restrictions and safeguards put on this bailout in the student loan market. So so far, no student has gone without a loan, and the infusion of capital has seemed to be working.
So this is an untold story, an untold piece of good news. We keep hearing about how the banks are hoarding the bailout money and not actually lending and unfreezing the credit markets. Student loan markets are the exception.
Absolutely. What Margaret Spellings did was she basically said, you know, we're not going to buy
the education secretary.
We're not going to buy loans from you unless you use the money to make more loans. And so despite the fact that about 168 lenders have pulled out of the student loan program, there has been no student that's gone without a loan. But I think the larger context here, the question that we have to ask is, why are these banks in the student loan market in the first place? Because there is an alternative. And that is direct lending.
Anya Kamenetz, staff writer for Fast Company, the author of Generation Debt and the Generation Debt blog. A little good news for a change. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
It's Not Just Friday. It's Follow-Up Friday, where we dig a little deeper on some things that came up briefly during the week. And perhaps no segment in the history of the show was a better setup for a Follow-Up Friday than our discussion with City Council member Gail Brewer about the looming conversion to digital TV. This segment had all the follow-up elements: confusion, anger, deadlines, complicated terminology, the complete package. Take a listen to a call we got during that segment from Francis in the Bronx.
I applied for a coupon back in December. This is about December 10th. I received my coupon around December 23rd, and I bought the box. But yesterday I tried to apply for a few friends, and we found out through the website that the program actually expired on December 31st. In other words, you had to apply by December 31st to receive the coupon.
Now, that was a coupon to get a discount on a digital converter box for those of you who only have old-fashioned over-the-air television, which will no longer work as of February 17th if this goes through as planned, unless you have a digital television or one of those converter boxes. So let's follow up on this story. It has actually continued to develop during the week, And there was big news on that today, as you may know, which is that the Obama administration has now come out for a delay in the deadline for conversion to digital TV and also for more funding for these coupons for which the funding had expired, as Francis and City Councilwoman Brewer were talking about. So let's follow up with Joel Kelsey, Associate Policy Analyst for the Consumer Union. They've officially called for a delay in the conversion to digital TV as well. Joel, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thank you.
And you have good company now because President-elect Obama is calling for a delay, too.
That's right. Also in the New York Times this morning, two former FCC chairmen, one Republican and one Democrat, agreed with a delay as well. So I think this is quickly shaping up as a nonpartisan issue.
It's been, what, 2 years since they originally set February 17th, 2009 as the date that everybody had to be digital capable? What's taking so long?
Well, unfortunately, the coupon program has hit its $1.34 billion cap. And so now we see a situation from our perspective where the federal government is making $19 billion from the sale of this vacated television spectrum and are asking consumers to dig into their pockets and spend an extra $50 to $80 at a brick-and-mortar retail store to pay for the miscalculation of the federal government. So from our perspective, we need to fix that problem with the coupon program, other flaws, and make sure that we do everything that we can to make sure the millions of consumers throughout America get the equipment they need to be sure to have emergency broadcasts and access to news and information on their television sets.
Dig a little deeper on the very idea of the coupon program. What does one of these converter boxes cost, and how much toward that cost is the coupon worth?
So the coupon program that was set up gives two $40 coupons to the folks who requested it on a first-come, first-served basis. Boxes cost anywhere from $40 to $80, $40 online, $50 to $80 in most stores. We've done extensive testing of 35 of the boxes widely available across the nation at Consumer Reports, the magazine of our organization, and all of it's available online for consumers to help navigate the transition. But again, the idea that this federally mandated switch is now costing consumers money to keep a picture on their screen, something they once got for free, is something that we feel is irresponsible, and we need to make sure that Congress, all of the relevant federal agencies, and the incoming administration do everything they can to mitigate the millions of Americans right now throughout the country that need to take some type of action to keep a picture on their television set.
And we saw you quoted in the LA Times today saying the list of who's to blame is long, but also that in that article there was an estimated 7.7 million households nationwide who may still find their screens going dark next month.
That's right. So, you know, from our perspective, now is not the time to continue to point fingers. That's been done for the last year and a half, 2 years. It's time now for everyone involved, Congress, the Commerce Department, the FCC, and incoming administration, to figure out what solutions we need to do to take to make sure that those millions of Americans throughout the country get the equipment they need to maintain access to emergency broadcasts, news, and information.
Why is this a government mandate anyway? Why doesn't the marketplace decide what kind of TVs we have? We can go out and buy the kinds of TVs we want. Why is the federal government coming in and telling Americans you have to own this kind of television?
Right. Well, you know, that's the question that we posed to Congress back in 2005, that similar to color TV, this isn't something you need to mandate. However, we're here now, and there's lots of wireless companies who gained the spectrum that's being vacated that want to use it for broadband. Public safety officials throughout the nation are eager to move into that space, and, we've moved past that point, and now we need to just figure out how to give everyone access to the spectrum they need, but also to make sure that the millions of elderly, low-income, and rural consumers throughout America have the equipment and the assistance that they need to be sure to continue to have access to emergency broadcast news and information.
From the calls that we got during that segment with Gail Brewer, it seems like this may be of particular concern to people who live in the city, because a lot of people are in apartments say that even with a converter box, their old rabbit ear antennas won't work, and that you have to put a new kind of antenna on the building roof.
Right.
And not everybody has the power to do that. Not every landlord is willing to do that. And so even with the converter boxes, a lot of people may be left in the dark anyway. Do you think that's the case?
That's certainly another layer of this very complicated onion is kind of signal strength and antenna quality. There's a number of different reasons that some consumers may lose a television station that they once got. One, people are referring to as the digital cliff effect, and this is the idea that digital signals are different than analog signals. Tall buildings like in New York, retaining walls, valleys can get in the way and degrade the signal. And so if you had a channel during analog that was a little snowy, maybe a bit fuzzy, you may not get that at all in digital. With digital, it's an all-or-nothing picture. If you get the picture, it's much, much better than what you had during an analog broadcast. But again, the strength of the signal is what's at question.
Once again, people are flooding our lines with questions about this digital television conversion deadline of February 17th and some of the technical questions. So let me sneak in a few phone calls for you. Joel Kelsey, my guest, associate policy analyst for the Consumers Union, and Joan on Long Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Joan.
Hi, how are you? This is Joan. And one thing I wanted to say is that I lost my card, my discounted card, and I misplaced it. And what about the money that I did not use to purchase this? The government still has the money there. It's still there. What about that?
How about that? Is Joan's money considered spent or unspent since she actually got the coupon?
That's a great question, actually. And I think she puts her finger right on one of the many flaws with the coupon program. All of the coupons have a 90-day expiration date on it. And after those coupons expire, the money goes back into the system. So although the Commerce Department has hit their $1.3 billion cap, they've given out all of the money that Congress has given to them. As coupons expire, they'll continue to send some out. However, from our perspective, a lot of the early actors back in March and April that didn't have many choices of converter boxes on the shelves were punished for acting early as their coupons expired. There's 13 million coupons that have expired so far, and we believe those folks should be able to reapply for coupons and have the assistance that they need to get the equipment to keep a picture on their television
set. Does Congress have to pass a bill to authorize more money to keep the coupon program from being broke?
Certainly. They certainly should allocate more money to the program to make sure there's enough available funds. But allowing consumers to reapply, we believe, isn't a question of law. It's just a question of political will of the folks that are administering the coupon program.
Dan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thank you very much. Let me nail down one or two, and I'll talk about non-commercial stations. I bought as a gift a converter for a friend in Long Island. Now, she gets Channel 21, non-commercial we're discussing, and the subsections of Channel 21, but she used to get a mediocre Channel 13 Zippo, nothing anymore.
She can't get Channel 13 with a converter box?
That's right. She used to get a so-so reception of 13 from the roof.
So have you heard about this before, Joel? Why would this be happening? And here in New York, Channel 13 is PBS.
Absolutely. As Dan mentions, there's a number of people out there who are hooking up their boxes and realizing they're missing some channels. There's a number of reasons behind that. One might be the quality of the antenna. The second might be the digital cliff effect that we mentioned earlier. The third could be what we're calling as digital dead zones, as some broadcasters are moving into their digital space, they're broadcasting to a smaller geographic area. So we recommend consumers, one, look at their antenna, two, call their broadcaster to ask if they're reducing the geographic area of their broadcast, and three, ask their neighbors if they're getting Channel 13 or other channels to see maybe if it's just a problem within their own with their own setup rather than a citywide or a municipal or a statewide problem.
And before you go, somebody else, we don't have time to put him on the air, but he says he's got his box. The quality of the image is great, but the sound is horrible. Have you heard that before?
That's a new one, actually. I think most consumers that are able to get the channels on their television set are saying that the sound and picture quality are much improved from analog, and I think a lot of folks will notice that. It is one of the benefits of the digital transition. However, again, we need to make sure that the millions of people across America that don't have the right equipment right now get what they need before the nation transitions to digital television.
And if the sound is bad on your television, boy, have I got a medium for you. But Joel Kelsey, Associate Policy Analyst for the Consumers Union, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
And that's our follow-up Friday, three parts, digging deeper on things that came up briefly during the week. Tavis Smiley next. Stay tuned.